Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the No Silica Cast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias, a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Today is Sunday, March 12th, 2006, and this is show number 34. It was a wet, rainy weekend in Southern California, and you know how cranky I get when my car is dirty. Luckily, it cleared up this afternoon briefly, so I was able to wash my car, even though it's supposed to rain again on Tuesday. Now, I don't care. If I get one good day of a clean car, that's worth it to me. Well, three new countries have joined us this week. I'd like to give a big welcome to our new listeners from Guatemala, Uruguay, and Myanmar, formerly known as Burma. I'm embarrassed to admit that while Burma was renamed Myanmar 17 years ago, I somehow missed the memo. I had not yet heard of Myanmar, so I had to go look it up and see what's gone on out there. I also am wondering whether the visitor from Guatemala might include my friend Alejandra. I sure hope so. We'll see. Last week, we talked about how to shut off the spell checker in Apple Mail. It was driving listener Jeremy crazy because it kept correcting his British English. Listener Mitch from the Netherlands found something even better. He figured out how to change the language, and it was in a pretty obscure place. Mitch was writing in Dutch, and he said the spell checker was just going wild. So he looked in the international preferences, which certainly sounded like a logical place to me, but it wasn't there. Of course not, because the international menu is filled with really logical things like the keyboard layout. In international, at least you can change the language for your entire system, but it does not change it for the spelling. Mitch continued to hunt and found this little tip. While you're working in a program that supports Apple's built-in spell checking, like Mail, Text Editor, and many other applications, you will have a spelling ... option in the Edit menu. Click it, and the menu will expand and give you some options like check when you click Send, that's for example in Mail, or other options that are relevant to the program you're using. But the first item in this menu is yet another spelling ... menu item. Note that you have to have something available to edit or this menu choice will actually be grayed out. So, you know, start typing a little bit of a mail or something like that and then go look for this spelling ... Within there, you can set the dictionary, put new words in, or remove /forget words. He thought if you chose a foreign language dictionary in one program, it might affect all programs that use Apple's spell checker, but I tested it by setting it to French and Mail, and then I went over to iChat, which does use the same dictionary, and it was still set to English. In the show notes, I've put a screen snapshot so you can see Mitch's discovery for yourself. Thanks for the great tip, Mitch. I'm sure that's going to help a lot of people out. Listener Pierre wrote in from Lima, Peru. Hey, do you know Paul from Peru? Anyway, and he asked an interesting question. He listened to my tutorial on how to set up VNC, Virtual Network Computing, to control one computer from another. I had tested not only controlling a Mac from another Mac, but also controlling a PC running Windows XP from a Mac. It worked just fine. Pierre asked whether I had ever tried using Microsoft's remote desktop connection to control an XP box from a Mac. I actually have done this, and I use it daily at work to access a PC for the few functions I can't do on my Mac. The reason this isn't the best home solution is that the PC has to be either running XP Professional, or I think maybe Windows 2000 Server would work as well. The PC also has to be running Windows Terminal Services. I'm not sure what RDC buys you over using VNC, but they both seem to get the job done, depending on your environment. Well, I love all the email feedback. Keep it coming. This is getting to be a lot of fun, a lot of people talking to each other, so keep up the good work. A while back, I did some reviews on different tools to make DVDs, take DVDs and rip them into your iPod. My friend Mike recommended PQDVD from pqdvd.com for the Windows users. I took a look at the site, and it looks like they've got all kinds of good solutions. They have three separate software packages for sale, one that takes video to the iPod, one to go to the PSP, and one that also does Pocket PC and Palm. The iPod version conversion software is $35, as is the PSP software, but I couldn't find the full price of the Pocket PC / Palm software. They showed an upgrade price of $15 if you had a copy of 1.x from Handango, and a competitive discount price of $22, but they didn't say what competitive software to use as an upgrade. The one thing they don't explicitly say, but you must infer, is that you have to rip the copy protection off of commercial DVDs if you want to use this tool to move your media to a portable device. Their exact phrase is, quote, watch iPod movies, TVs, home videos on the go. I guess they meant TV shows when they said TVs, but they specifically did say home movies, which is kind of the opposite of commercial, right? The one thing you can tell is if you find a conversion piece of software that costs money, I guarantee it doesn't take the copy protection off. As soon as it does, then the RIAA guys come swooping in and put them out of business. But if they're doing it for free, they don't seem to catch up with them so much. So the fact that this costs $35 tells you that they're not going to rip it for you. You need another tool to do that. This PQ DVD supports a lot of formats, which is pretty cool. They support TiVo, DivX, MPEG, WMV, AVI, Real Media, and more, quote unquote, which is pretty capable for the price. My friend Mike says it's a good product and he's pretty discerning. So if you're looking for a Windows solution, this sounds like something you might want to go check out. You guys might be getting tired of hearing me talk about this cool software called Media Central. That's the competitor to Apple's Front Row product, but it just keeps getting better and better. I reviewed it a while ago, and the problem with Front Row is that it only comes on new Macintoshes, but well, there's a hack where you can get it onto old Macs, but it doesn't work all that well in my opinion. Media Central, in contrast, is freeware from Equinox.com and works better in my opinion. It's faster at accessing media, it has a much better interface to photos, and it accesses more video formats than Front Row. The only downside is that you can't use Apple's remote control, available for new Macs with the IR detector. It does support several types of Bluetooth cell phones instead. Well, the folks over Equinox have come out with update 1.2.1, and now Media Central supports the IR remote too. I tested it out today and it works great. The one thing I'll ask for them next is the ability to start a song from iTunes and then switch over to Photos, so it's my music playing in the background of my slideshow instead of theirs. At the rate they're coming out with updates, I won't take too long, I'm sure. Listener Robert sent in a review of an interesting product. It's called the Pantone Huey from Pantone.com. The problem this device solves is adjusting the color on your monitor to ensure you're getting true colors. I believe this is critically important for folks that are in the print media business. They have to ensure that what they see on screen is what will actually get printed. This doesn't solve a problem for me personally, but I suspect there are those out there who might be interested. This product works with both Windows and Mac, so everyone gets to play. Robert got his for free when he attended the Color Control Freak seminar in New York City last month. Greta G. Macbeth hosted the event, and you can learn more about that at graphintel.com if you're interested. For the rest of us peons, this product sells for around $80 US. Robert suggests that I'm a gadget geek. I like the sound of that, kind of rolls off the tongue nicely. And he shares this passion. He loves this cool little device. He says it attracts a lot of attention in his office, and everyone wants to know what it is. It's a monitor calibrator, and what makes this different from other calibrators is that it continuously monitors the ambient light in the room and adjusts the screen every 10 seconds. It sits on his desk right in front of his CRT and flashes three red lights. Looks like a little radio antenna. Personally, I'm thinking of buying one just because of the flashing lights, because it sounds, it looks pretty cool. Aside from the constant light adjustment and gadgetness, he also loves how easy it is to set up and the speed at which it creates the monitor profile. He also has a Spider Pro 2, which works great, but takes about 5 times longer to set up a profile. The Huey reads the monitor color in about 2 to 3 minutes. The Spider can take as much as 15 minutes to create the same profile. He wasn't sure which profile was actually better. They seemed about the same to him. No good review is all glowing, so he did mention one thing about the Huey that he doesn't like. It only works on the main monitor. This can be frustrating if you do color retouching on another monitor. For him, this meant he couldn't use it at home, where he has 2 19-inch Samsung monitors for doing layout and palettes, and a Dell Trinitron to do his PSD work, his Photoshop work, which is not his main monitor. For this reason, he's still using the Spider 2 at home and the Huey at the office. Well, I'm sure it's obvious what the problem is there. Get rid of the Samsung monitors. We hate Samsung, remember? Oh, just kidding, Robert. Mostly. Thanks for the detailed review. Both the good and the bad makes it more useful. I'm sure there are other people out there who will want to check out this cool little gadget. Head on over to Pantone.com and look up the Huey. So there's a really cool screensaver built into the Mac operating system that came with Tiger, I believe. It's a dreamy kind of blue background with swirling letters that snap into place and show you a set of 9 entries from the website Slashdot, which, by the way, is a great tech news website. The snippet that shows up has a number at the bottom, and if you hit that number on your keyboard, it jumps out of the screensaver and into your default browser and goes straight to the full article on Slashdot. It's a very dramatic screensaver, catches a lot of people's eyes from a distance. People are always walking in my office saying, "Wow, what's that?" And I used to like it a lot because it had generic articles on Slashdot, but somewhere along the line, it turned into a Mac-specific part of Slashdot. There's a section within Slashdot if you only want to read Mac news. But I want to go back to the generic Slashdot. I was wondering if anyone knows how to change what site's RSS it uses. So, I mean, maybe you don't even want to read Slashdot. You want to have a different RSS going. I'd still like to use Slashdot in my case, but I want more broad-based tech news. As much as I like Macs, I find all Macs all the time rather boring. Hope I didn't offend anyone there, but that's how I feel. So if you know how to change that screensaver to look at a different RSS feed, I'd sure be interested in finding out. I'd like to continue my MacBook Pro review. Now I think I'm into week 3 here. And a lot of people have been talking about the fact that the MacBook Pro does not have a PCMCIA card slot. That's the wide slot that was on the side of the PowerBooks where you could slide in a card. And I find this kind of humorous because until about 6 months ago, I'd never figured out what to stick in there anyway. And I'd had PowerBooks for about 5 years by that time. Research department Niraj suggested I buy a memory card reader to throw in there, and I was delighted with that solution. No messy cords and separate card readers to carry around and not have with you when you really need it. So I got that card reader, and then it was always in my PowerBook. It was really, really nice. But that option is closed to me now because the MacBook Pro uses the new standard, which is called the Express Card 34. It's narrower in a completely different format, and there are hardly any cards out there for them yet. Well, I came up with a cheap and easy and relatively clean solution to the problem. Not perfect, but still will hold me over until the cards are available, and it might have multiple uses in the future. I bought a little gizmo from Lexar. It looks like a rather bulky thumb drive, but you can open up the end of it and stick in an SD card, and voila, it's a card reader. It's very small, very light, and costs a grand total of $16 US. I put a picture of it in the show notes so you can check it out. I seem to be running into more odd effects on the MacBook Pro, but they're not necessarily traceable back to a root cause. At work, every once in a while, Apple Mail just hangs up and spins forever during an address book lookup. It doesn't happen all the time, and it does eventually come back, but it's more than a couple of minutes while it spins. Sometimes I'll go get a cup of coffee or something to see if it'll come back, and it does. But if I have to sit there waiting, I'll just hang myself first. I've tried using another mail client, and it didn't seem to have a problem with lookup at all. Still don't know what's going on there. I am still having to go wireless because of the problem with the voice over IP network at work conflicting with the MacBook Pro. I talked to Apple today, and they are working on a fix for that. There's an odd problem after an hour and a half with AppleCare didn't solve. It was almost 2 hours. It was an hour and 55 minutes. I can burn to a CD from iTunes once, but the second time I try to burn it, it fails. It fails with all different errors, from media errors to error 802006E. But the most interesting one was once when it said it could not calibrate the laser power for this media. Oh, that sounded cool. Anyway, after nearly 2 hours on the phone with AppleCare, they were unable to fix the problem. So it looks like I might actually have a hardware problem. It's a drag, but I still have my PowerBook, so I should be able to survive while the new toy is gone. One thing that totally bums me out is that NeoOffice won't run on the Intel-based Macs. NeoOffice, as you might recall, is the Macintosh version of OpenOffice. And while it's not one of my mainstream applications, I frequently use it to open files that Microsoft Office can't open. I know it sounds strange, but every once in a while I get an Excel file that the Mac version of Microsoft Office can't open, so I usually flip over to NeoOffice. Well, I went to their website, and it said specifically, this package can only be installed on a PowerPC machine, and it cannot be installed on an Intel-based machine. I don't understand. Come on, it should be able to run in Rosetta in emulation. It should be fast enough to hold it, but it doesn't. So I'm bummed about that. Hey, do you have too many friends always bothering you, wanting you to join things? You need to check out Introverster at airbagindustries.com. I love the premise of this site. Clearly, the authors are sick and tired of all these touchy-feely social networking sites that are all about how to make more friends and share pictures and share bookmarks and all that. Instead, they advertise that their tool, Introverster, will allow you to prevent stupid people and friends from harassing you online by avoiding invites to chat, filtering out annoying invitations for meetup, birthday parties, or after-hours get-togethers, or helping friends get a clue that you really don't like people or care for idle chit-chat. They invite you to create your own barrier to protect yourself against interaction with people. It's easy and fun. Check it out at airbagindustries.com. Last week, I mentioned that I know an easy way to remove wrinkles from a person's face in Photoshop Elements, and I asked whether anyone would be interested in that, and I got some email that said that you would. So I'm going to do a tutorial on it, and I've created a little video file that I used Snaps Pro to film not only my voice, but also the screen while I was working in Photoshop Elements. The video works perfectly and the audio works perfectly, but I'm stumbling right at this exact minute on how to put a banner at the front that does a little introduction. I thought I'd be able to put it in after the fact, but I'm having some technical difficulties. Hopefully that video will be up tonight, but if it isn't, it'll be up very, very soon. So for now, what I'd like to do is an audio-only version of for the podcast. This tutorial will certainly work in real Photoshop as well as Photoshop Elements, and I'm willing to bet it will work in the GIMP, which is an open source alternative to Photoshop. Maybe I better tell you about the GIMP in a later episode. I enjoy the success of this technique if the person is generally happy, smiling with their eyes showing. It still works if they're not, but the effect is much more dramatic if they are. In my little video tutorial, I used a photo of former President Jimmy Carter. He's a great subject because he has a beautiful smile and his eyes smile too. The first step is to make a copy of the person's head onto a second layer. This is best done using the lasso tool, which you can activate by hitting the L key or clicking on the icon on the left-hand side. Then you want to encircle the entire head and a little bit of the surrounding area, like some of the collar and maybe the background behind the head. Copy this area and then do an edit paste. Look over on the right side under layers to ensure that you have a new layer with just the head. So you should have the entire photo and then the layer above it should be just the head. What we're going to do next is blur the heck out of this new layer. I want you to select Filter, Blur, Gaussian Blur, and then you'll be faced with a slider bar that says Radius above it. Slide this bar back and forth and watch the face in the real picture. You want to concentrate on wrinkles like crow's feet, you know, the lines coming out from the eyes, wrinkles in the neck, maybe laugh lines around the mouth. Not the real deep ones, but the finer lines. So drag that slider until you just see the wrinkles fade away, the ones you don't like. You want them to be completely invisible, but don't worry about the rest of the photo. It will be absurdly blurry. You can adjust this later, so don't worry about getting it just perfect. Click OK. Next, we're going to reduce the effect of the blurring by changing the opacity of this blurry layer. Over on the right, in the layers area, you'll see a pull-down for opacity. Slide this bar back and forth, watching the wrinkles, and move it until it just gets rid of the wrinkles the way you'd like. Now that you've got that set just right, we need to bring back his sparkly smile. To do this, we're actually going to erase parts of the blurry layer. Again, make sure that the blurry layer is still selected. Go get your eraser tool and set the size in the upper menu slider bar until it's maybe half the size of the eyes or three quarters the size of the eyes. Then erase the blurry layer over the eyes, and you'll see the sparkle jump right back out at you. Be careful not to bring back bags under the eyes or the crow's feet, though, so make sure you stay right on the eyes. You may need to enlarge the eraser a little here, and next erase over the teeth and mouth to bring back the shiny teeth, and pick up the detail on the lips while you're at it. Now you might need an even bigger eraser, but erase over the hair, which will bring back the crisp look there too. You don't want the hair blurring out. Next, erase around the edges of the face so that you get a good definition against the background and around the collar, again being careful not to bring back the chicken neck. I also like to erase with a tiny brush around features like the end of the nose, whatever looks too blurry for you. Remember, you can still mess around with the opacity and the blurriness if the effect isn't enough to make Grandma look good or if she's disappeared into a bland face. Remember, you want to preserve character while softening the effects of age. To see how much improved the photo is, click the little eye next to the blurry layer on and off so you can see it change back to the original and to the new and improved version. Once you're sure you like this new photo, save it as a JPEG and you'll get a flattened version for future use. If you want to be able to go back and mess around with it more or to wow your friends with your newly learned talent, be sure and save the image as a full Photoshop or .psd file as well. If this was too hard to follow through on audio, check in the show notes at podfeet.com and look at the video tutorial, when I get it finished, that is. If you like this tutorial, drop me a line at allison@podfeet.com. Back in show number 20, I told you about a whole bunch of cool things you can do with Google, like solve equations, do unit conversions, and find packages supposed to be delivered to you. I just found a few more that might be useful as well. If you want to check on an airline flight, all you have to do is type the name of the airline into Google, followed by the flight number, and it will return the flight status. Another good one is if you want the weather, just a quick little bit of weather, like you want to find out if it's going to rain Tuesday and get your newly washed car wet, simply type in weather and any city and state for a quick illustrated report. I found these tips in a great Time magazine article all about Google. It's a fascinating story. They also have a tip on searching that I hadn't thought of before. They suggest that instead of searching using a question, search using the answer. The reason for this is that the answer is more likely to be posted than the question, so that's what you should search for. I tried typing Ryan Seacrest is tall instead of how tall is Ryan Seacrest, and the answer came right back on the top hit. He's 5'7", if you're wondering. Hope these tips make your Googling experience more valuable. Have you run into the problem of trying to send a large file to your friend, but your email systems limit your file transfer to a paltry 3 megabytes or maybe even less? There are several solutions out on the web for this problem. The one I've used is called YouSendIt.com. That's YouSendIt.com. The website has a simple interface. You enter your friend's email address and a message, then select the file you want to send and click Send It. The file's size limitation is 1 gigabyte and uses encryption, which they say ensures your message only goes to the person you intended. After you send the file, the screen shows the message, "Your file has been successfully sent. We've stored your file on our server and sent your recipient an email with instructions for receiving it. The file will be available for 7 days or a limited number of downloads." They also include a link to the file so you can download it again without a new upload. Even though they talk about encryption and using HTTPS, I watched the URL throughout this process and I never did see it say HTTPS. But I'm not a security expert, so I wouldn't take that as a definite problem. I just found it curious. The site is ad-supported, but you only get ads after you've uploaded the file. I like that because a busy site will turn me off right away, and the opening screen for YouSendIt.com is as simple and clean as you could hope. I heard Dropload.com recommended as well, but it leaves a lot to be desired. First of all, it requires an account. You have to create an account and an email and a password and all that nonsense. And the file size limit is 100 megabytes in contrast to the 1 gig over at YouSendIt.com. Given my choice, I'd go straight to YouSendIt.com. There are some fascinating developments in the world of science reported this week. This week, there were two cool discoveries. There was an article on Adelphia.net that shows a photograph of a beautiful creature. It's a new crustacean. It's an off-white color, and it almost looks like it has feathers. The photo was released by the French Research Institute for the Exploitation of the Sea, and it's called Kiwi Hirsuta. This adorable shellfish has no eyeballs and is 15 centimeters long, which is almost 6 inches. It was actually discovered a year ago, March, but I guess we weren't ready to hear news like this for a while. So if you're ever hanging around the hydrothermal vents of the Pacific Antarctic Ridge, south of Easter Island, keep your eyes open for this lovely little creature. Keep your eyes open, because he doesn't have any eyes, and maybe he'll run into you. As if a new crab wasn't exciting enough, CNN.com is reporting that a rat squirrel, once thought to be extinct for the last 11 million years, is actually alive and well in central Laos. I'm starting to think conspiracy here. This article also says it was discovered last spring. Why are they waiting a full year to get this information out to us? This so-called rock rat, he prefers to be called Diatomidae, was first thought to be an entirely new species, but the scientists involved in the discovery say that it's even more exciting that it was gone for 11 million years. I wonder where rat squirrels go for that long. This isn't the first time a creature has reappeared after a long absence. Scientists call it the Lazarus effect. If you're riveted by this topic, head over to the link in the show notes and you can read up on a primitive fish that existed before the dinosaurs and was thought to be extinct for 65 million years. On that inspiring topic, I think I'll bring this episode of the NoSillaCast to a close. As always, feedback is very welcome at allison@podfeed.com. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.